President Obama broke the Republicans once on taxes. Now he's betting he'll do it again on the sequester fight. What are your thoughts as the sequester cuts are just days away? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa join me to offer analysis on the political and economic fallout of sequester cuts nationally and here in Iowa. Governor Chris Christie becomes the 8th GOP governor to buck his party, throwing his support behind Medicaid expansion under the president's health care law. What's Governor Branstad's position and why? And Michelle Obama's charm offensive draws fire. What's the role of the First Lady anyway? Politics Day on River to River after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this snowy afternoon in Iowa. It's Politics Day. Snow doesn't get in the way of that here on Iowa Public Radio. Doing that for us today, the analysis, that is, we have Dennis Goldford of Drake University joining us by phone today. Thank you for joining us, Dennis.
It's my pleasure. I'd rather be in Cancun doing this, I think. But, stop the snow.
We will heat up the conversation to make you feel as if you're in Cancun.
There you go.
Without all the high-rises and the glitz. Okay, good. Chris Larimer is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. He's in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
And we want to talk about the significant number of political developments on the landscape. Of course, the sequester, we're counting down the days. Friday is the day when that will kick in. President Obama broke the Republicans once on taxes. Now he's betting he'll do it again on this sequester fight, and it's coming to a climax. President Obama went to a Virginia shipyard yesterday to talk about the looming sequester and the harm the across-the-board budget cuts would cause, especially to industries like Newport News Shipbuilding, which supplies the federal government.
So here at Newport News Shipbuilding, you guys have made an enormous investment because we've said, in order to maintain the finest Navy that the world has ever known, we've got to make sure that there is an orderly process whereby we are continually upgrading our ships, building new ships, maintaining our ships properly. And these are some big ships. So it's expensive and it's complicated. And you've got 5,000 suppliers all across the country. And you've got to have some certainty and some knowledge about how things are going to proceed over the long term for Mike and others to plan properly. So you're rightly concerned, Mike is properly concerned about the impact that these cuts will have on not just this company, but companies and small businesses from all 50 states that supply you with parts and equipment.
Meanwhile, House Speaker John Boehner criticized the president's appearance as campaigning and questioned why he hasn't spent his time sitting down with the Senate to hammer out a deal that avoids the sequester deadline.
The president has been traveling all over the country, and today going down to Newport News in order to use our military men and women as a prop in yet another campaign rally to support his tax hikes. Now, the American people know the president gets more money, they're just going to spend it. And the fact is that he's gotten his tax hikes. It's time to focus on the real problem here in Washington, and that is spending. The president has known for 16 months that this sequester was looming out there when the super committee failed to come to an agreement. And so for 16 months, the president's been traveling all over the country holding rallies instead of sitting down with Senate leaders in order to try to forge an agreement over there in order to move a bill. We have moved a bill in the House twice. We should not have to move a third bill before the Senate gets off their ass and begins to do something.
House Speaker John Boehner this week. River to River listeners, your thoughts, your questions about what you've been hearing on the sequestration battle. Do you think the president is emphasizing unity or taking a partisan approach? What do you think about the criticism that the president is using the military as a prop? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email, Iowa Public Radio, also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Gentlemen, Chris and Dennis,
Dennis, let's talk about the strategies in each camp here. Let's start with the administration. Dennis, what is the Obama strategy here? The powers of the office, bringing them to bear?
Well, the difficulty, as I've said at times before, is that you're trying to move, if you're the administration, you're trying to move Republicans to go along with what the administration wants. But the political pressure on the Republicans doesn't work as well when these guys and women have been elected in districts that are overwhelmingly Republican themselves. The whole idea for the sequester recall was the idea that since Congress couldn't seem to find some way of dealing with these awful issues, they'd create some sort of, if you will, electric shock for both sides. In other words, if they didn't find some agreement on the budget and spending issues and taxing issues, then the Democrats would possibly be faced with loss of services, which they wouldn't want, and spending in domestic programs, and Republicans would be faced with loss of spending on the military, which they supposedly don't want. So they'd both face undesirable consequences, and that was supposed to bring them to the table. The difficulty for the administration is that there's a significant block among the Republicans, particularly on the Tea Party side of the party, who are quite happy with the sequestration, because for them that means simply money's not going to be spent, and they're very happy with that, and that undermines the administration's calculation in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Chris, unlike the previous fiscal fights, the House Republicans, Dennis talked about it just there, feel they're in a pretty good position on this one. Why have they not caved up to this point?
Well, I think they're a little bit worried about just being seen as caving again. I mean, if we think back to how we got into this mess, and Dennis alluded to it a little bit with the Tea Party movement, a lot of this can go back to the results from the November 2010 election, when you had a number of Republicans supported by the Tea Party movement coming into office on the idea of smaller government and reducing government spending. And then you have this drawn-out debt ceiling crisis in 2011. It's finally solved at the last minute. In a case where they were able to give President Obama a debt ceiling increase that got him through the 2012 elections. And that was seen for some Republicans as sort of this failure. And so then you had this super committee. They couldn't agree to these massive cuts. And then that's where we get the fiscal cliff where we are now.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, Republicans then are betting, at least the Tea Party Republicans, are betting, Dennis, that that these $85 billion in sequester cuts set to take effect on Friday won't tank the markets, and the public won't feel the impact. Is that the bet there?
I think it is. I mean, I think, I can't remember which governor said, Republican governor, I think, said that any governor can take 2 or 3% out of his budget without any great massive difficulty. And I think they've estimated, in terms of the overall federal government, really this is pretty small. But Republicans have talked a lot about the need for confidence on the part of the business community and investors. And, yeah, they are, I guess they're convinced that this won't shake that confidence the way the debt ceiling issue in 2011 did.
Mm-hmm. The president out, it seems, on the campaign trail, trying to speed this result, maximize the pressure by releasing state-by-state details of the pain, the suffering this sequester will cause at the shipyard, as we heard in that. Chris, does this have precedent in presidential politics, that we seem to still be on the campaign trail? At least that's the criticism of some Republicans.
Well, I'm not sure if it has precedent in terms of dealing with this particular issue. You know, there have been attempts in the past to try to reform the budget process through various pieces of legislation. You know, the sequester idea really goes back to the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act from 1985, which set this idea of target deficits. And then, of course, they didn't meet their target deficits, so Congress reformed the process, and now they didn't have to meet those deficits. And we're kind of in the same position now. So I don't think there is necessarily precedent for the president on this particular issue, but it's not surprising that the president is using this. You know, he has the bully pulpit that we always talk about, and he's using this as his opportunity to present his case. And frankly, I think it's a much easier case for the president to make than for Republicans to make. Republicans, you know, they're part of Congress. They're part of the legislative branch. They're seen as the ones who are supposed to be dealing with this process and dealing with the sequestration and passing bills to get this done. And, you know, I think it's kind of ironic that you see Speaker Boehner out there talking about the super committee failed. Well, the super committee was made up of members of Congress, and they're the ones who failed, and that's why we had the fiscal cliff that was supposed to go into effect January 1st and now is March 1st.
Mm-hmm. Well, the exact effects of sequestration in Iowa are unknown, but if we localize it to this state, the extension economist Dave Swenson of ISU says there are concentrations of federal employees and industries in Iowa that will be harmed.
If you're in a community, let's say in and around the Quad Cities where you have the Rock Island Arsenal, where you do have a high concentration of federal employment, or you're in Des Moines where you do have a very high concentration of both military and non-military employment in and around the Des Moines area, those impacts will be felt.
And when asked about the likely impacts to Iowa, Governor Branstad says workforce development, education, and defense are the most likely to be impacted by federal cuts, but he also used the opportunity to talk about another issue tied to federal spending.
It's their budget. It's their sequestration. The president signed the law, and we now have to deal with it. That's exactly why I have misgivings about signing on to this Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid expansion. We'll get to that other issue in just a moment, Chris Larimer. But talk about this, what is the view from the separate states, Iowa in particular? We heard Governor Branstad there on the sequestration.
Well, I think most states are still trying to figure it out exactly what's going to happen with the effects. I mean, what Iowa State economist Dave Swenson said, I mean, he's, you know, the expert in this area as far as predicting the economic loss. But I think most states are still trying to figure this out. There really is not a lot of precedent for a sequester going into effect, these across-the-board cuts. Usually Congress does not let this happen. And so I think most states are trying to figure out exactly how it's going to affect particular programs and how quickly it's going to affect programs, because these cuts will go into place, but then you're going to see agencies adjusting along the way. It's not like a government shutdown where you simply just don't have people going into work for a few days, but then the funding comes in later. This is a cut, and I think most states are still a little uncertain about the impact.
Mm-hmm. And there has been some claim, as Chris says, that quite rightly, that this won't be this sudden car crash, so to speak. It will be something that sort of takes a while to get up and running, this sequester. And the impact, therefore, won't be immediately obvious, at least some people have suggested.
1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Perhaps your job is somehow tied to sequestration. We'd like to hear from you, 1-866-780-9100. We're on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk a little bit about what Governor Branstad mentioned in that clip just a moment ago. Move on to that. Yesterday, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie threw his support behind Medicaid expansion under the president's health care law. Now, Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey became the eighth governor to buck his party and align himself with President Obama on the issue. So we have eight Republican governors doing this, dare I say, flip-flop. What's going on here, Dennis?
Well, it's awfully hard not to take money, even if the concern is that the money has strings. Obviously, the federal support for the Medicaid expansion is to cover 100% of the cost for the first period. I can't remember if it's 1 year or a couple of years. And then the feds would back off a little and cover 90%, and the states would have to come up with that other 10% of funding that seems only to grow. So Governor Branstad, I think, is concerned fiscally about what would it cost the state, and would the state be left holding the bag if the federal government backed away even further. But, of course, he also opposes the whole Affordable Care Act and the Obama administration's health care policy. And so doesn't really want to validate it by participating in it. But, the irony is, Rick Scott, I think, governor of Florida, who made his name in the healthcare field and made his multiple millions in the healthcare field, has actually turned around. And after opposing this, he's agreed to support it, at least for the time being. But you've got some Republican governors, in a sense, saying I can score some points with some people by accepting this money and ensuring people of low income and do some good there. They run the risk of irritating their Tea Party supporters when they do that, however.
Mm-hmm. Chris, your view on this?
Well, I think part of it is, for a lot of these Republican governors, it was a very you know, gut and immediate reaction to the Supreme Court ruling last summer where, you know, basically validating the Obamacare legislation, and the only out for states was to this idea that they could refuse Medicaid. So I think immediately Republican governors refused it as sort of a political stance. But now, as it's, you know, the policy is getting ready to go into effect, you see some of them coming back for exactly the reasons Dennis mentioned. You know, for Governor Branstad, the fact that he continues to refuse the Medicaid expansion, I think, is interesting. You know, he's certainly leaving it out there as an issue for the governor's race in 2014.
Could it become a big issue in that race?
I think it could, particularly if it would somehow, if it would go through the Iowa Senate, if the Iowa Senate would pass legislation on Medicaid expansion, and you would actually see the Iowa House push that through. That's probably unlikely, but if that would go through, and not only would Governor Branstad be refusing Medicaid expansion, but actually have to veto legislation at that point, I think that would be make it a very significant issue for the governor's race next year.
Mm-hmm. How does this, Dennis, how did the eight governors turning 180 degrees on this issue, how does that shape the adoption of what has come to be called Obamacare across the country?
Well, this is what opponents have been fearing for quite some time. They've been concerned that as different pieces of it lock into place and people get used to certain kinds of policies and certain kinds of funding, it would be awfully difficult to, if you will, kick the habit. It would be awfully difficult to undo all these things as they become locked into place and people get used to them. So Republican governors who turn around and support this, again, as I said, they risk the ire of the Tea Party because they help, from their standpoint, enable the operation of a policy that they fundamentally oppose. Now, other people who welcome the policy or are neutral toward it may well give them some credit for this, but they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100, Politics Day. Here on River to River, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Jake joins us from Des Moines. Hi, Jake.
Hi. I have a comment about the sequester.
Go ahead, please.
So what I think is, I've been thinking about this recently, and I haven't heard this reported. It's just a theory of my own. But the Republicans, the whole sequester, I don't think is much of a mix-up, and it's just a, what are we getting ourselves into? I think it's more calculated than that in terms of, Republicans represented that they were so scared of defense cuts that they would come to the table. But in reality, I think the military-industrial complex even has a little bit less pull than Wall Street in terms of just big money donors, backers. So the Republicans' primary goal is low taxes for the top 0.01%, because these are the people that pay for the campaigns. Now, I think the Democrats are duped by this. And really believe they cared about the military more than tax rates for the rich, or they were complicit and they've been compromised by those same big money 0.01 percenters, or at least some of them have.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jake from Des Moines. Reaction to that analysis from Jake, Dennis, or Chris. Anyone want to jump in there?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to say if the military is really losing any clout, but I think, you know, Jake is right that you see, I mean, the difference between Republicans and Democrats, it goes back to the debt ceiling crisis in 2011, where you see Democrats not wanting to move on entitlements and Republicans not wanting to move on this issue of revenue or taxes. And I think, you know, we're in the same spot. Here we are February 27th, 2013, as we were in August of 2011.
Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, are you worried about the sequester? How will it impact you if it does? Will it impact you directly? 1-866-780-9100. David is joining us from Iowa City. Hi, David.
Hi. As I listen to the Affordable Care Act and watch it unfold, I'm reminded of the 1970s change in car insurance. And I don't know if any of your guests remember that, but it was a program that was trying to be handled on a number of state levels or at the state level, because that's how car insurance is regulated. And yet there was this overwhelming national mandate that said there's going to be a change. We're going to have to deal with this. And the individual states were left with trying to figure out how to do that. The debate seemed to center around, we're going to require insurance companies to provide certain benefits, and this is going to be included in our state legislation. And in exchange for this, the companies are going to have the law on their side, and everyone's going to be forced to own car insurance. Such wasn't always the case, and some of us tend to forget that, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so the lessons you're learning, or you're drawing the parallel, is what exactly?
That we had a mess in the 70s over car insurance. Premiums went through the roof. Insurance companies were backing out of marketplaces. You can read that as states, left and right. There was just all kinds of a mess until the states kind of finally got their act together and decided that they were going to do it in the right way, and we were left with the system that we have today. I'm really scared to death that this whole health insurance situation is going to get worse before it gets better, and that's my reason for why.
Mm-hmm. Worse in what way?
Just messy. Just probably very high premiums. I was reading an article in Time Magazine, this week's Time Magazine, as a matter of fact, where the cover story is about this issue. And actually, it's about hospitals being behind the cost increases. Anyway, and the point, and one of the major points he makes is that no matter what happens, we're going to have increasing premiums. They're going to go through the roof because... Okay. Insurance companies are being asked to take all of the limitations off of the coverages they're providing.
David, thank you for that, and we'll try before the break to see what reaction we have to the several comments, the points that you raised. Dennis?
Well, I think for the people who oppose Obamacare, I think their concern is that they oppose it not because it might not work. I think they're concerned that it will work, and they find it a fundamentally incorrect policy, not something that we should be doing. One of the arguments for Obamacare has been that it will lower or at least decrease the pressure on healthcare premiums, as the caller was concerned about. And at least some of the things I've been seeing more in the conservative press now suggested that that has not occurred. The premiums are still going up. So the jury's still out on that. And we have to remember that the bulk of the whole Obamacare or Affordable Care Act system really isn't quite in place yet. So we don't know how this is going to work.
Mm-hmm. 2014, the year that a lot of it comes into effect, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Chris, before we go to break, any comments to wind up this particular point?
No, I think Dennis hit it pretty good there.
Okay. When we come back in just a moment, we want to talk about, a couple polls on the latest parties. We want to reach out to our listeners and ask you the same question that I think the Pew poll, well, actually, NBC News, a Wall Street Journal poll, asked if President Obama, in his sequestration actions in the last few weeks, is emphasizing unity in the country or taking a partisan approach. What do you think? 1-866-780-9100. Also, when we come back, how do you see the role of the First Lady? Michelle Obama has been quite prominent in popular media in the recent days. Of course, the surprise appearance, if you watch the Oscars, that telecast this weekend, she announced the big award for the night's best picture. Also this past week, late night with Jimmy Fallon doing a dance, I think called the Evolution of Mom Dance. How do you see the role of the First Lady? Do you feel Michelle Obama has gone too far in her charm offensive? That's what some conservative critics are saying. Join our discussion, Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or send us a message through Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News on this snowy afternoon across the Midwest. We know that climate change is dramatically and adversely affecting habitats of many endangered species, but did you know it's also skewing the male-to-female ratio of certain animals? Tomorrow on this program, my guests are two Iowa State University researchers who study how climate change may be reducing males in sexual reproduction of such animals as turtles, lizards, and fish. Also tomorrow on this program, geologist Chris Brochu of the University of Iowa on the new findings about the death of the dinosaurs millions of years ago. Tomorrow on this program. Today, Wednesday, it's Politics Wednesday, and we're taking up a lot of our time talking about the update on the sequester after weeks of argument over the sequester. Bipartisan congressional leaders meeting with the president on Friday at the White House. That's the same day the automatic federal spending cuts are scheduled to go into effect. The president meeting with House Speaker John Boehner, Minority Leader of the House, Nancy Pelosi, Majority Leader Harry Reid, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to discuss these across-the-board budget reductions to federal agencies. And that's the latest news on that. We wanted to hear from you. How will it be affecting your life at all? What are your thoughts? What are your worries? 1-866-780-9100. And you can also write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Post a message on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Mary Jane joining us from Iowa City. Hi, Mary Jane. What's your view?
You know, I was listening to your panel, and I jumped on, I think, about 12:15. So if this was discussed before then, I do apologize. But I was rather disappointed that no one brought up the deficit. And, you know, many of the Republicans are taking a lot of heat right now because, you know, the issue is they're just trying to protect their base, keep taxes low. And, in fact, that is not the main issue. Mm-hmm. The main issue is the deficit. And I would love someone on your panel to explain to me why we should not be concerned about the deficit. Over 50% of the people in this country are extremely concerned about our skyrocketing deficit. And there is no consensus on the Hill. Obama pays lip service to it, but he never follows through. It's all about raising taxes. So what does your panel have to say about that?
Mary Jane, let's get to Mary Jane, concerned about nobody talking about the big problem, the deficit. Dennis, your reaction, your comment.
There's no question but that the deficit itself is a long-term problem. We cannot sustain that kind of spending at that level. But short-term, there's... It's always the case that during a recession, deficit spending goes up because government tax revenues go down through because of income tax and sales tax and so forth, through automatic stabilizers like unemployment insurance. Deficit spending or deficits always go up during the recessions, and getting out of the recession itself will help to some extent to deal with the deficit as opposed to the debt per se. But one of the things Republicans did was get people to think that the deficits caused the recession. Actually, what happened was that the recession caused the deficits of this dimension. But there's certainly a problem. And Republicans, many Republicans, I think, in good faith, want to tackle the deficits. But if deficits are indeed the overriding problem, then there are two ways of dealing with deficits. One is to spend less, and one is to have more income or revenue. Mm-hmm. And Republicans would rather sacrifice the revenue, in other words, refusing to have any kind of closure of tax loopholes, for example, than use that for closing the deficit.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if austerity is a way out of an economic downturn such as we have now, Dennis?
Paul Krugman's been making that argument in the Times for quite some time that it hasn't worked. And, of course, he's a controversial figure, even if he is a Nobel Prize winner. But he keeps pointing to England. He said England went the austerity route and their economy is just in the dumps. You know, if you go back to basic macroeconomics, gross domestic product equals consumption spending plus government spending plus investment plus net exports, which is always now for us a negative. And when consumer spending drops, one of the reasons why government spending goes up is to sustain that level of economic activity. And when you take more money out of the system by cutting that spending, you get a downward spiral and less money circulating, fewer and fewer people with jobs and so forth. That's the standard argument that Krugman makes.
Okay.
I think, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, on the deficit, Dennis is absolutely right. Everybody is concerned with it. It is an extremely important problem. But, you know, the latest report from the Congressional Budget Office has the deficit down to, you know, right between 5% and 6% of GDP. Now, economists want it down to 3%, but it has dropped over the last year. I mean, we did have the trillion-dollar deficits for 4 years, but now it's at least under $1 trillion. It's down to 5% or 6% of GDP. So there is some movement on the deficit right now. It's just what do you value? And as Dennis said, do you value, you know, reforming the tax code, or do you want to do it through other discretionary spending measures?
Okay, Mary Jane in Iowa City, we hope that satisfied your query there. Thank you for calling. And
thank you.
Heather is with us from Des Moines. Hi, Heather. What's on your mind?
Hi. My husband and I are both veterans, and we attend school full-time on the VRAP program, which is funded, is very similar to the GI Bill. And we have no idea if the sequester is going to completely do away with our benefits, if we'll have to drop out of school. We have no idea how it's going to affect us.
I wonder. I don't know if we have the experts in Dennis or Chris to answer that question. Chris, Dennis, probably not.
I certainly don't know. I mean, no. One question would be, if the Pentagon has X dollars fewer than it had, can it reshuffle some of those dollars to use in certain areas to cover for the time being? If they can move money around, who knows whether they put it toward this particular program or whether they'd use it for acquisition of military equipment. We just don't know at this point.
Mm-hmm. No, I was going to say, Heather, the White House did put out those press releases for each state as far as how the sequester would hit it. And for the military, they just had two categories on military readiness for the Army and Air Force. So that's about the extent of the information that I have.
Mm-hmm. We have the information I have is 1,500 civilian military employees in Iowa could be furloughed if those cuts do go into effect. That was according to a Pentagon spokeswoman yesterday. Some government workers in the Departments of Education and Workforce Development also likely to be furloughed. But Heather, have you contacted or thought about contacting your members of Congress with your concerns, your questions?
We haven't yet, just because we don't know if it'll affect us or not. But now that you guys don't know either, I think we will be contacting them.
Sorry.
We are not the Sorry. Only ones in uncertainty here. Our governor, to the same effect earlier this week, not really knowing how these sequester cuts will fall out here in Iowa if they actually do occur. This meeting, wrapping up this conversation on the sequester, this meeting to take place Friday on leaders, both Democratic and Republican, in the White House. Now, Chris, what is the sense of having a meeting at the end of this long run-up to this sequester? Could anything really be solved on that last day, you think?
Well, I don't think anything's going to be solved. You know, they may look for a short-term solution. We may see another sort of extension of a deadline, or at least maybe a drawback in some of the $85 billion that's supposed to go into effect. But, yeah, I mean, if you're having it on Friday, obviously the sequester is going to go into effect. I'm guessing they're looking – they're probably doing two things, trying to figure out where the sequester, how to solve that, and then also starting maybe a conversation about – remember, we have the continuing resolution that comes up March 27th for – the current fiscal year for the budget. And so I think, you know, there are a number of things on the horizon that they have to start dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Morgan is with us from Manchester here in Iowa. Morgan, I understand that your family will be affected by these cuts if they do come into effect.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That is correct.
How?
Well, my father is a federal employee. He works for the Iowa National Guard as a federal technician. And if the sequester is put into place, he will lose 20% of his annual income, which will amount to about $12,700, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely going to impact my family, and if it does happen. And my family supports four kids. And so it's definitely not a pleasant thing to think about.
Right. When it impacts you, though, directly, Morgan, I'm wondering how this makes you feel from afar here in Iowa, looking at the politics going on in Washington. Has it changed your view there?
Well, my viewpoint has been kind of the same overall, but yes, it does affect my viewpoint. I wish that they would come together and compromise and at least not make one sector of the population pay for all the cuts that need to be made.
Morgan, thank you very much. We hope it's not too painful for your family there. Manchester, Iowa. Morgan, thank you for calling.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. We wanted to talk about a couple of other things, even though sequestration is the dominant political news of this week. Chris and Dennis, I'm sure you noticed that yesterday more than 80 of the nation's most prominent Republicans, including top officials of all the recent Republican administrations and presidential campaigns, came out publicly in favor of a constitutional right to same-sex marriage that, in a brief to be filed this week with the Supreme Court, it involves a challenge to California's Proposition 8 That was a 2008 ban on same-sex marriage, now being reviewed by the Supreme Court. A lot of names here that work behind the scenes or have in many of Republican politics in the past few years. Dennis, why the shift in the GOP among this significant group? Why now?
Well, we have a Supreme Court case coming up in terms of the Defense of Marriage Act. So that's something that has a particular resonance this particular spring. And interestingly, based upon Proposition 8 in California, and insofar as that's related to this, you know, one of the people, we have this odd couple of David Boies, or Boies, who was litigated for the Democrats in Bush v. Gore, and Ted Olson, who litigated for Republicans in Bush v. Gore way back when. They're both on the same side, pushing, in essence, for some sort of same-sex marriage right. There's a certain cultural conflict within the Republican Party, and you've got some business leaders, for example, who were critical of the leading candidate for governor, the Republican nomination for governor in Virginia, who's very hardline Tea Party, very hardline anti-same-sex marriage, and they're concerned that pursuing his policies does not make a helpful and welcoming business climate for the state. So there are business reasons some of these Republicans are coming out this way. Some of them may well think of it in terms of certain kinds of moral reasons. But there is, you know, people used to say, what was going to happen when you put together a sort of three-martini-lunch country club Republican with a teetotaling everyday working Republican? Mm-hmm. And that's this sort of populist versus elitist Republican culture clash that we're seeing a bit of right now.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, how do you see this apparent split developing in the GOP on this issue?
Well, I think part of it goes back to what we're seeing, you know, generally since the 2012 election, is that, you know, Republicans feel like maybe they're losing ground in several sort of subgroups within the electorate. And certainly within Iowa, we've seen views on same-sex marriage moderate considerably since the November 2010 election, when we, you know, that we did not retain three Supreme Court justices. And so I think that mood is generally changing across the country. You know, we had, I think it was Maine and Maryland, and then Washington, you know, approving same-sex marriage on the ballot in 2012, the first time that that went through on the ballot. So I think you're generally just seeing a shifting of the attitudes within the electorate, and you're trying to see the Republican Party keep pace with that shift.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, how likely do either of you see that if we spin this out, this dramatic change in public opinion towards same-sex marriage that has occurred over the last few years, are we likely to see a presidential nominee in 2016 for the Republicans be in favor of same-sex marriage, when we had Mitt Romney and his runner-up, Rick Santorum, both definitely against it in the last one? Could it change that dramatically for 2016 in the Republican Party, Dennis?
I'd be surprised if it changed that quickly. I mean, maybe long-term it would change, but you know, religious conservatives, out of fully sincere beliefs in what they consider the proper moral code and religious code, they, if not a majority of the Republican Party, they're certainly the tail that wags the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And no Republican presidential candidates can get elected without them. Their support doesn't guarantee you will be elected, but you absolutely cannot get elected without them. They've voted in recent presidential cycles 4-1, 80% of them for the Republican candidate. And if Democrats lost the support of African-American voters, the way that would cripple them, their presidential prospects, this would cripple Republican prospects.
Okay, on to First Lady Michelle Obama drawing criticism for a surprise appearance on the Oscars telecast this past Sunday. Mrs. Obama announcing the big award for the night, the Best Picture.
And the Oscar goes to Argo.
Michelle Obama also making a late-night appearance this past week on the Jimmy Fallon Show, doing something called the Evolution of Mom Dance, this giving rise to some conservative critics, columnists saying that Obama's role at the Academy Awards went too far, trivializing the White House, made both the president and the first lady seem small and grasping. Chris, your thoughts on this? The role of the first lady is really not defined anywhere. Each first lady makes of it what she will.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, so Michelle Obama is an extremely popular figure. We see that in poll after poll. And so Now she's being criticized for being too charismatic. If you remember, Republican critics criticized Hillary Clinton when she was first lady for being too involved in the policy process. So what, you know, so what exactly should be the role of the first lady? I mean, if being out in public doing public events is too much, or being involved in policy is too much, it doesn't leave much room there.
Mm-hmm. Bridget wants to weigh in on this, I believe, calling from Greenfield. Hi, Bridget.
Hello. Yes, I agree with Chris. In fact, I'd like to see more of her out in our face. She's an awesome first lady, and I think we should see more of her. And what she does is really good, whether it's on the Academy Awards or the school lunches or whatever. And that's
you don't think there's a danger, Bridget, of overexposure, or that she needs to be a little bit more choosy with where she's going?
Not as a first lady of this country, no. I think the more she's out there in our face, the better it is.
Bridget, thank you for weighing in from Greenfield. Dennis, you haven't talked about this. Perhaps we could compare a little bit Michelle Obama in comparison to other modern first ladies.
Well, you know, first ladies normally in the past would pick a particular project that would be relatively inoffensive to most people, and they'd work away at it with sort of good, wholesome sort of project. Other first ladies have, remember, Hillary Clinton was a much more in-your-face first lady than we had had before. Nancy Reagan's main job was to cast her adoring gaze on Ronald Reagan. The press used to call it the gaze, the way she'd look at him when she'd sit next to him when he'd speak. But Michelle Obama's a highly educated woman with a law degree, and it's not as if she actually went there and had a whole Secret Service retinue that disrupted the proceedings. And indeed, given the way Republicans like to talk about Hollywood as an overwhelmingly liberal and democratic kind of constituency, in a sense, she was an ambassador to an essential democratic constituency, the way a Republican showing up at a National Rifle Association meeting does the same thing for Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Also raises the question, though, do you think Michelle Obama has a political role in sight after 2016?
No.
No, she has. No. She has. What has she exactly said about that, if you can recall that, Dennis?
I can't recall if she's actually said it in those terms, but she's given no indication whatsoever, certainly not compared to the way people thought about Hillary as a prospective candidate, even during the Clinton years. She's tried to be a very non-political a figure, and I don't think showing up and announcing this award from the White House through video link and everything, that was really not a particular political kind of activity.
We've got a couple minutes left. I've been pitching questions and aspects to the two of you. I wonder if, looking forward to the next coming weeks, if you have anything we haven't mentioned, Chris, that you'll be especially looking at.
Well, you know, certainly the sequestration and how that's resolved, and sort of what sort of timelines we're looking at, and, you know, how they get through the sequester and the continuing resolution, you know, whether there is sort of any resolution. But I also think, you know, maybe at the state level, are we going to start to see major pieces of legislation move through the Iowa General Assembly, and, you know, if we're going to see any big movement on education or property tax reform.
Okay, so those are the two issues. Yep. We should be watching at a state level, property tax reform, education. Dennis, from your corner, the forward look from you?
Sure. On the state level, not so much policy, but politics, I'm interested to see who might emerge as a likely Democratic candidate for governor, since Congressman Braley is going to run for the Senate. But at the national level, we have to remember today the Supreme Court is hearing a case involving the Voting Rights Act, and the way quite a number of states, overwhelmingly Southern, if they're going to make any changes to their voting practices or voting laws and procedures, they have to get clearance from the Justice Department because of the history of discrimination over the years. And Alabama is challenging this, saying this is out of date. We don't need this kind of protection for voting rights anymore.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute, Dennis. I'm glad you went there because I'd like your thoughts on the significance of that Supreme Court tackling the Voting Rights Act.
Well, it would serve in symbolic terms if they were to overturn it. On the one hand, the people who support overturning would say, see, we've moved on from the terrible conflicts and controversies of the past. Symbolically, the people who support retaining it would say, you're sweeping all that under the rug. There still are all sorts of difficulties out there. So it's major, but I mean the changes the Voting Rights Act caused in the South were massive. I mean, if you got to the point, as we did years ago, for listeners who remember George Wallace, mm-hmm. and segregation now and segregation forever. By the end of his political career, he was actively seeking the votes of African-American Alabamians. And the fact that there was that kind of change in Southern political culture was massive and due largely to the Voting Rights Act.
Chris, any impact on this decision, the Voting Rights Act here in Iowa? We were not one of those seven states.
Right. So I don't think we're going to see much of an impact. As Dennis said, this is really more for those the Southern states that have to deal with that particular clause in the Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, quickly, the Senate approved Chuck Hagel's nomination for Secretary of Defense. A mm-hmm. contentious battle there. Do we see any battles coming up in terms of those types of confirmations coming up?
Well, maybe just with Jack Lew to see how Senator Grassley moves forward. He didn't vote for him in the committee. We'll see how he votes on the Senate floor.
He's been opposing Jack mm-hmm. Lew, I believe, at this point mm-hmm. as well. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Chris Larimer and Dennis Goldford. As always, it's a pleasure to have your insights about the politics of the day. Thank you both.
Thank
you.
You're
welcome.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Cedar Falls. Help from Tony Daner. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow on this program, my two guests, Iowa State University researchers who will share how they're studying climate change may be reducing males in the sexual reproduction of turtles, lizards, and fish. Also, geologist Chris Brochu of the University of Iowa on those new findings, perhaps you heard them, on the death of the dinosaurs some 66 million years ago, I believe, if my memory doesn't fail me. Next time on River to River, River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.